This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Home Depot and Target got hacked last year. Millions of customers had their personal data compromised. Then Sony Pictures got hacked and a national security standoff with North Korea ensued. Yesterday, U.S. Central Command got hacked by sympathizers of ISIS. What made this cyber attack doubly embarrassing was the fact that President Obama was actually giving a speech at that moment on cybersecurity. Analysts say that cybercrime costs as much as $400 billion a year, and the biggest impact is felt by people like you and me.
So what steps do you take to ensure that you're safe online?
I try not to open emails. I think I don't recognize it, just discard.
Just limiting the amount of information that I put out there and making sure I go to the right protected sites.
Probably not enough. Use a credit card that has fraud protection on it and hope that's enough.
Have you ever been a victim of cybercrime?
Not that I know of.
My husband had problems just with his debit card being hacked. Really don't do a lot online because of that.
It's a pretty big worry, especially after that Target issue. My sister actually got her debit card messed with. I guess somebody bought some stuff off of her account after she had shopped there.
Okay, so it's happened to a lot of people. Those are some voices gathered in West Hartford by WNPR's Kate McAuliffe. So today, Where We Live, cybercrime. We're talking with experts this segment about what threats exist, what we can do to protect against them in this digital age. Join us with your thoughts and questions, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can safely comment on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live. Joining us in studio is Brian Ford. He leads the Decentralized Distributed Systems Research Group at Yale University. He's an expert on cybersecurity and secure systems development. Brian, welcome to Where We Live. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You heard the people who we interviewed on the street. A lot of people seem concerned about this. How concerned, broadly, should we be about our personal cybersecurity?
Absolutely very concerned. It's a huge problem, and I believe one that everyone needs to educate themselves about in today's world.
When we hear people say things like, you know, I don't open up emails that I don't know where they come from. I worry about what happens with some of my digital information online. I mean, what are the few things, and we're going to get into some details, but the few top line things that people might really need to know getting out of this when it comes to protecting your own personal cybersecurity?
Yeah, those are actually absolutely important general principles for, you know, being very careful about email. The basic problem with email is the internet's email system is basically antiquated, and it was never designed with security in mind, you know, decades ago when it was created. And therefore, it's not only important to be suspicious of emails that look suspicious, but it's also important to be suspicious of emails that look like they come from your friends or your family. I would say, especially, you know, don't click links in any email if you can avoid it, unless you absolutely know that the email was generated for you. Somebody or some site you visited created the email for you. Just don't click links in email. If there's an email that say to go to some website and confirm your account information or anything like that, go to a web browser and type the website that you think is in the web browser. Don't click the link from the email.
Oh, those are some simple things, and we're going to be talking more about some specifics as well throughout the course of the program. If you want to join us with your questions, 860-275-7266. I want to bring in also David Thaw, who's an assistant professor at the University of Pittsburgh, another expert on cybersecurity and cybercrime. David, welcome to our program.
Thank you very much.
Aside from the things we just heard from Brian Ford, what are some other top-line hints and tips that you give people, things to watch for when protecting themselves in the digital world?
I think one of the most important things for consumers to remember is sort of the old adage that if it looks off, it probably is off. There tends to be sort of a pattern that attack emails, attack websites. We see this now on social media as well. There might be a little bit off in the language. It might be just different than the marketing dress, so to speak, for Bank of America, if that's your bank. And having sort of that savvy consumer eye to look, does this feel right? And anytime it doesn't, I would reemphasize the same advice. perhaps at a little more generalized level, of go directly to what you know. We used to say if somebody calls you and says, I'm from Bank of America, give me your personal information, you'd worry if it was a boiler room scam. And you say, you know what, let me just call back the main number. It's similar in dealing with online questions. Well, let me just visit bankofamerica.com because I know that website.
When we all heard about the hacks of Target or Home Depot last year, an awful lot of people took advice to go and change their passwords to just try to think a little bit more clearly about how they use passwords online. David, I guess I'm wondering how important is that, and do more complex passwords or changing passwords more often actually keep us safe?
To a point, the requirements of imposing this on users is more shifting a burden onto the consumer that they're not well positioned to bear. So complex passwords, while they may make certain types of attacks more difficult to execute, there are much, much better mechanisms of defending against those attacks. I'd almost even go so far as to say that those attacks should almost never be capable of being executed by an attacker. There's other defenses that can be put in place. And when you ask a user to remember something very complex and then remember a new complex thing every 30, 60, or 90 days, you're inviting them to make a mistake.
So,
by inviting that mistake, you invite them to use an alternate method to fix it, say reset their password. We're all familiar with this link. Well, that's how compromises can happen, because the information you use there is very common, and that's what can be looked up in public information.
Yeah, this is very true, and this brings up, you know, some of the technologies that I think can be effective in improving and moving us away from over reliance on traditional pure password based security, which is definitely a dead end. Things like two-factor authentication, when implemented well. Of course, two-factor authentication can be done right and it can be done wrong.
Explain what that means, yes.
So basically, two-factor authentication is where you have to have something and know something. So password authentication is one factor, in that it's only based on what you know, something you know. Whereas two-factor authentication, you have to have a smart card or something else, a little device of some kind that the bank mails you, or, you know, it comes in many forms, but it just, you know, when it's done right, it makes it a lot harder for attackers to steal. And that's one of many technologies that can significantly improve security when it's done well.
What about things like biometrics? Or, you know, I just got my new iPhone 6 and I can put my thumbprint on it and it can wake up for me.
So,
I mean, how advanced are we? Is that stuff working well enough for us yet?
So biometrics is an interesting, complicated topic. On the one hand, it can be effective in some respects as a form of two-factor authentication. But one of the key problems with biometrics, especially if you use only biometrics, is in some cases it can actually be worse than passwords, because a password you can change. If your password gets hacked, you can change it to a new password. If my fingerprint gets stolen, I can't change my fingerprint. So then what I do? So it's much more cut. So actually deploying biometric authentication in a secure fashion has to be taken, you know, incredibly carefully.
I've seen this happen in movies, and it's kind of scary how people take someone's fingerprint. I mean, can you digitally take someone's fingerprint these days fairly easily?
So it's rapidly getting easier. In fact, in the research community, just in the past couple of months, there was a proof of concept. A security researcher demonstrated that they could take some photographs of a person's fingerprint off of I can't remember, it was a glass or something, and reconstruct it digitally into a form that could be used to falsify a biometric authentication.
So David, this sounds fairly scary, that if we're getting down to the point where we can falsify someone's fingerprint, well, then that doesn't seem like the most secure way to keep our information.
And it's not. And similar types of concerns would apply to the what we possess factor of authentication as well, which could be a smart card. And additionally, the problem of we're not always in a situation where we can use what we possess. A card works very well at an ATM, for example, if we're at a computer in a coffee shop that we're working at somewhere or traveling. There may just simply not be an interface available to use that for authentication purposes. One of the things that more recent research coming, for example, out of Carnegie Mellon has revealed is that passwords perhaps aren't as much of a dead end as we thought they were, and it's rather been a failure of implementation of the authentication systems for passwords, which caused the breakdown in the system, which is admittedly very widespread today.
We're talking with David Thaw and Brian Ford. They're both cybersecurity experts, and we're talking about personal cybersecurity in the first segment of our program today. We're going to be moving on to how big businesses, companies like Target or Sony Pictures, may have gotten hacked and what they're doing to stop it. Later on in the program, we're also going to be talking about utilities here in Connecticut trying to take steps to make sure that they're safe from cyber attacks. You can join us at 860-275-7266 if you have your own thoughts and questions about staying safe online or in a digital world. One of the things that I think is new to many people is this idea, Brian, of the Internet of Things, interconnected devices that aren't just your computer or your tablet that you sit down and spend some time with where you know it is a digital connected device, but things like your refrigerator or your pill bottle or something that's in some ways connected to the Internet. Maybe you can talk a little bit about how the increasing prevalence of this Internet of Things may be another way in which we can be compromised.
Yeah. Well, I'm not an expert in particular on the Internet of Things, but as a security person in general, the trend of product marketers pushing us to connect more and more non-traditional computing devices to our home wireless networks and in general to the Internet is scary in that we haven't it increases the security problems in part because these devices typically don't get software updates. They don't get maintained like you know an Android phone or a Mac OS system. Often, you know, you buy a router, you buy a TV, you buy one of these things, and the software that you get when you first purchase it, well, you use it for 5 years or however long until it breaks, and it often never gets updated in that time. And if that thing is connected to the Internet, you can basically be dead certain that it has holes that, you know, during that time, some hacker will figure out how to exploit. Right. And so this kind of gets back to another of the general security, pieces of security advice that everybody should be aware of. Make sure you always keep your software up to date. And in terms of kind of Internet of Things connected devices, before you buy one of these things, make sure it has a way to keep itself up to date or that you can configure it to get updates. Otherwise, you're basically setting yourself up as a big, or your whole home network up as a big fat target for anybody who comes down in a few years and wants to exploit an old, by that time, vulnerability.
David, when we talk about something, anything being a big fat target, we hear about something like 150,000 different viruses being placed by hackers into the system a year. I mean, how many targets are out there? How many people are actually looking for the weaknesses, whether it's in our Internet of Things or our personal information? I mean, do you have some sort of a sense of the scale of the problem we're talking about?
So I think the best way to understand the scale of the problem is by understanding how cheap it is to add the next attack for any given attacker. So in the old days, if you were going to rob a bank, you had to, as they would say, case the joint to figure out which bank you were going to rob. If you're going to virtually rob a bank or virtually try to steal a consumer's wallet, executing that attack against 1,000 computers is trivially different in cost to the attacker of executing it against 1 million. And that's where the problems of scale come in, is they can simply just add more attacks until they find one against which their attack method works.
Mm. David, do you have any more thoughts before we take a break on this idea of connected homes and some of these other devices that we were talking about a moment ago?
I agree very much with what Brian said, and I think I would further add that as we're talking about connected homes and even connected medical devices, which can become a part of us, remember that the organizations which are developing and maintaining them, their core competency is not security. And that can make them a big fat target, so to speak, because when something is not designed with security in mind, it opens up the opportunity that it may be used in a way other than the designers intended it, because they didn't build in that security or, as Brian was discussing, a way to fix it later when the vulnerability is discovered.
We're talking today about cybersecurity. Obviously, it's a big issue, a series of speeches by Governor or by President Obama this week about it. We're also taking a look at it on the state level as well. More on our threats to our personal cybersecurity and also threats to business and government coming up. We're going to take your calls and questions at 860-275-7266. You can also email us where we live at WNPR.org. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with cybersecurity experts about what seems to be an increasing threat to our digital lifestyles. Recent reports have highlighted attacks against companies like Target, Home Depot, and Sony. Many other companies around the world, the global business community routinely suffers losses in the hundreds of billions of dollars. Of course, these losses always start with the money we first pay for the goods and services, then are passed down to us in the form of higher prices. So what should we know about cyber crime against business, and how can we protect ourselves online and at the checkout line, something that President Obama's been talking about?
The internet and e-commerce are keys to our economic competitiveness. But cyber thieves have cost U.S. companies billions of dollars. As consumers, we use the internet to pay our bills, to shop, to file our taxes. But millions of Americans have been victimized. Their privacy violated, their money and identity stolen, their lives turned upside down. The lesson is clear. This cyber threat is one of the most serious economic and national security challenges we face as a nation.
And that's President Barack Obama speaking back in 2009. He's speaking an awful lot about this issue again this week. So we're talking about cybersecurity on the program today. If you want to join us with your thoughts, 860-275-7266. A quick call here from Luther, who's calling from Glastonbury. Hi, Luther. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up, you know, in the face of businesses and the military not being able to protect networks, our state unanimously passed a law 2 years ago to mandate the availability of internet voting for troops and overseas voters, and mandating the state or our 169 towns to implement it. Even though the vast majority of computer scientists say it's impossible. And I remember, Dan, you ran a forum on that at Central Connecticut about 3.5 years ago.
Yeah, we talked about that a little bit ago, and there were people from different states saying very different things about whether or not this was a good idea. Luther, thank you very much for the phone call. I'll just quickly ask Brian Ford about this. I mean, this is one of the concerns people have. There's so many ways in which we can make our lives theoretically easier. It seems obvious that we should be able to vote online, but Luther points out one of the potential problems here. My goodness, if we can hack into, whether it's Sony Pictures or CENTCOM, we can hack into an American governmental system that takes votes in, and that could cause a huge problem.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, it's extremely difficult to build a voting system that's intended to be used in an important governmental election that we can really have high confidence in its security in all sorts of ways for all sorts of reasons. Even if it's done well, there are major problems that we, even in kind of the security research community, don't really know how to deal with in a online voting scenario, such as the problem that voting systems are supposed to be resistant to coercion. You know, if somebody wants to buy large amount of votes, just post on Twitter, hey, I will I will pay a dollar for everyone who, you know, gives me their voting password so I can vote for my favorite candidate, you know. We don't know how to do that, to solve that when with unrestricted voting online, even if every other aspect of the system is implemented correctly, which it usually is not. Usually there's other huge problems in typical online voting systems, too. You
know? And that does, just even that scenario sounds like a very scary scenario indeed. You know, in a little bit, we're going to be talking more about government's role in all this and how government is protecting itself. But I do want to bring in now Arthur House, who's a chairman of PURE, the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority in the state. He's got a background in national defense, security, and intelligence agencies, including the Department of Defense and the Department of National Intelligence. And Arthur House, welcome back to the program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good to be here with you, John.
You know, in just a couple minutes, we are going to be turning a little bit to how the utility agency that you work with may protect itself. But maybe you can just talk a little bit more broadly on the threats that you see to American business and, of course, through American business to our own pocketbooks today. You hear the president talking about it right now. How big do you see this threat?
Well, it's serious. In just 2014, you had major companies, J.P. Morgan Chase, Home Depot, Target, Neiman Marcus, Yahoo, eBay, AT&T Communications, all were hacked. It seems like there's penetration just about everywhere. The one I'm especially concerned about is Sony, because up till now, we've been able to categorize the penetrations into three categories. One, people looking for money. Two, people seeking to steal industrial secrets. And three, what the military calls battlefield preparation. In other words, getting ready to do an attack, which would in effect be an act of war. Sony added a fourth element, which is revenge. We'll show you. We're going to cause havoc here. Now, that's a whole new motivation, and it's added, I think, a lot of concern in the business community that they may not be just looking for money or industrial secrets. They may also simply be trying to settle a score or get even with you. And so, yes, it's a very serious problem. And every American business now has to have a serious cybersecurity program.
Is there a difference at all with the Sony hack that has to do with this and we're going to talk a little bit about this later, but I'd like to maybe get your take on whether or not we're talking about individuals with a grudge or a gripe, or we're talking about state actors, someone who is actually based in or paid by North Korea or some other governmental organization that says, we want to get at an American business or an American governmental agency.
That goes right to the heart of it, John, exactly. And what we've seen are two additions. One is the sophisticated individual hacker with the tacit support of a nation state, a lot of that in Eastern Europe. But what we appear to have on the Sony one was the active participation of some nation states. The countries we worry about are places like North Korea or Iran, which believe they have already been attacked. Iran, because of the Stuxnet crisis, which we can talk about if you'd like, but whereby their centrifuges spun out of control, and the media reported that it was a joint operation by the United States and Israel. They believe they've already been attacked by the United States, and therefore, in taking actions against us with the support of a state, that they are, in fact, retaliating, not taking initial offense.
You know, one of the things that David Thaw that I wanted to ask about in this segment as we talk about the threats to American business is that in many ways, direct threats against American governmental agencies it's very, very important. We talked about it, about whether or not we're going to have secure voting online someday soon. But in many ways, because of the way our economy works right now, an attack against a large American corporation is almost an attack against the United States government. I mean, it can have a debilitating effect on our economy. How big do you see the threats to directly, David, to really big multinational companies that are based here in the United States?
Very substantial. And one of the key differences that I think we need to remember is the model of understanding state-based threats during the Cold War and earlier periods was at a time when a much larger percentage of critical infrastructure was either handled directly by the defense industrial complex or handled by very closely associated entities. So much of our private critical infrastructure has now been developed and maintained by private organizations, and that's fostered amazing innovations. We carry many of these devices around, and they're built into our cars, and we talk about a lot of these types of things. But what that means is that we no longer have sort of a built-in mindset coming from the Defense Department of we must protect this. And research has shown again and again that the competitive private marketplace does not drive security, which is a substantial concern. So we do need to have, I believe Brian mentioned earlier, that individual organizations do need to have a security plan, and there need to be ways to ensure not only that they know they need to have it, private organizations, but that they have the tools to understand how to build it.
But why isn't this a driving factor? I mean, why aren't companies that could be so compromised in this way, why aren't they leading the charge toward better cybersecurity?
I think many would want to if they could effectively compete on it. But when research shows that banks can't compete on better cybersecurity, and consumers will make choices primarily on other factors, it makes it much more difficult for the leaders of a company to justify the very substantial expenditures to the shareholders and boards of directors to which they're accountable.
Brian?
Yeah, so I think to add to that, I completely agree. And to add to that, one of the problems we have is an economic incentive problem. What we effectively have in the cybersecurity market is what economists, I think, like to call a lemon market, where you know, everybody wants to claim to have, you know, secure, high security or 100% security. But you know, anybody who actually claims to have a 100% secure product, I would say that's the first tell. You want to run the other direction as quickly as possible.
Of course.
So, but because the current market for secure products, both in the commercial world and in the government world. For one thing, most of these products are closed. The code for them is proprietary or secret, and very few people can actually inspect it. Which means that the general public or other broad security experts can't actually look at it. And so everybody's claims about security are essentially on equal footing. And so the incentives are to actually create products that aren't secure. But I, if I'm a software developer, I win in the market by getting an insecure product to market first before the other guy, spends a lot more time getting a secure product to market.
Arthur, I think that one of the things, though, that is just shocking to me about that is we've all heard about people having their identities stolen online and a credit card company, for instance, having to make good on thousands of dollars worth of purchases. And that's just one micro example of something that happens day after day after day and increasingly in the world. Why is it that you think, at least, that the private marketplace isn't leading a charge here? I think both of our guests, Brian and David, make some good points, but it just seems as though security is really the frontier that private business should want to get into more than anything else, because we want to live in a more secure world because there's a lot of threats out there.
Brian and David are right in that this is one expense that a company has to look at. Look, companies are in business to make a profit, to thrive, and so forth. So you don't want to overinvest in a particular area. You don't want to do more than is necessary. And if you get caught short and you get hacked and you have a problem, then you've done too little. But it is not in their interest to overinvest in any particular area. That's exactly when we get into the cyber problem for Connecticut Utilities. What is our interest in seeing that Connecticut Utilities invest enough in cybersecurity? Because if, take a household products company, they get hacked, they lose some money, their products maybe get delayed and so on. If you get hacked and your water supply is not forthcoming or you don't have electricity, that's a public issue. So I agree exactly what they said, and the reason is that cybersecurity is one of many very necessary expenses you have to make today, and it's just as easy to overdo it as underdo it. So they want to hit the sweet spot, and that's almost impossible to predict.
I want to get to some phone calls here. Bill is calling from New Milford. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. Very interesting discussion, and I think when it comes to something like security, there's lots of different ways for people or companies to be attacked, whether it's viruses or malware or bad security built into software. But at the end of the day, a chain is kind of only as strong as its weakest link, and in many cases, that weak link is us, is people. And our password habits. And it's one thing for us to all use our dog's name for a password for all our accounts, but as soon as we go to work and we start using all these cloud-based apps that are out there that are part of business now, and we start doing that, that's how things possibly like yesterday's CENTCOM attack. Their Twitter account was hacked. Who knows if it was a bad password, but it wouldn't surprise me if it were, and that seems like such an easy thing to deal with compared to what we're doing now. I run a small business, and we use a password management tool called Meldium, and nobody knows the passwords to the Twitter account. They just know how to use the tool, and the tool protects is a layer of protection between the account and the person. So if someone leaves the company, they don't have the master password to any of our accounts. And it seems like we're not doing enough to tell businesses that at the very minimum, you know, you can't protect everything, but you can do some things, and you should at least try and pick off the low-hanging fruit.
And, Bill, it's a great call. Thank you so much. And David, it sounds like a lot of the low-hanging fruit, as he suggests, is us. I mean, there are those purely technical hacks at which you're really getting into code. And then there is all the socially engineered attacks that we read about, the ones in which, honestly, the weak link is really human behavior. And how do we guard against that?
The weak link very often is human behavior. But I always caution folks to be very, very careful about overprotecting, particularly with passwords, because that can use that very weak link of human behavior against us. The password manager example, it does solve certain problems, but it also creates what we call a single point of failure, which means if you compromise that password manager, perhaps by pretending to be someone of importance within the organization who is running late to a meeting on site with a critical client that we're trying to sell our product to, and I need to get in right now, and I'm really an attacker calling the help desk, I suddenly got all the keys to the kingdom.
Yeah, and that doesn't... That doesn't sound very good, Brian.
Yeah. Yeah. So this is, you know, one of these instances where you know, password managers can be good and bad. You know, the benefit is obviously they ensure that you aren't ending up using one password across a lot of different services. That's a very good thing. It's you know, a really bad idea to use the same password across a lot of different services. Because if the hacker breaks into one, they automatically get all. But as David said, if you're going to use a password manager, you got to be really, you know, really confident that that is a good one. And this gets back again to ensuring that evaluating the, you know, the products you get, where they come from, who reviewed them, are they open source or closed source, what independent security experts have analyzed them or vouched for them.
But the other piece of this, the human problem we're talking about here, Commissioner, is just really something that we have seen at the state level, something we've seen businesses have problems with. A lot of people work from home. They take home a laptop. They leave the laptop in the car. The laptop gets stolen. They bring home a USB drive that has a terabyte worth of information on it now, and that can very easily just be stolen. Or maybe some of the ways in which you secure your home wireless system. These are all things, as we're sending more people to work remotely, are causing a whole new set of problems.
You're exactly right. And that means that your cybersecurity prevention program has to be cultural. It has to be company-wide and get down to every single individual. I mean, look, it could be as simple as one company left thumb drives in the parking lot, and they could have colorful names like, I don't know, Wild Cowgirls or I don't know what, Sports Update on them. And they come in, they stick it in the machine just to see what they found. And, of course, what they've done is completely compromise it. So,
yeah, and this was a test they did.
Yes,
test. Actually, yeah, you put all these drives out. Do people put the thumb drives in their computers in work? Yeah,
some did, yeah. And that's the point, that it goes all the way down to every single employee. Look, the national security. It used to be in national security, we had to compromise a Secretary of Defense or a major official in another country. Now all you need is the cleaning crew with a thumb drive, mm-hmm. and you can get a lot of the same material you used to have by high-level espionage. So, yes, it is corporate-wide, and it gets down to every single employee.
I want to get to a few more phone calls before we take our next break. Paul's in Windsor. Hi, Paul.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Lots of companies are now encouraging cloud-based storage. How concerned should we be about pushing data to the cloud when we could also be opening up a can of worms here and giving hackers a greater pool of resources to go after?
Hey, it's a great question, Paul. Well, what do you say, Brian?
So again, as with many technologies, there are pluses and minuses to cloud-based storage and cloud-based technologies. On the upside, if the system is run by a reputable company, you know, Google or Microsoft, they probably have large teams of engineers internally devoted to making sure their cloud based system is secure, you know, to whatever the extent they can. So that's to the extent that their security teams might do a better job than I would just personally at home keeping a dealing with the security of my personal devices or my hard drive at home, that might be a good thing. On the other hand, it creates another what David called it, a central point of failure. Anybody gets into your cloud account for whatever reason, in whatever way, they suddenly have access to everything, and the potential damage they can do is potentially much more severe and potentially much more immediate as well. They can potentially lock you out of your account and then run away with all your with all your data, or so the damage, the potential kind of remote damage, can be much more severe. And a third aspect is your data can be subject to insider attacks at the companies that are managing it. Depending on what the company's internal protections are, maybe just a rogue system administrator, who knows what they can do. And again, we don't know. Looking in at these companies from outside, they can say they're secure, but typically we don't know.
Well, I want to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more about national security threats from cyber warfare. We're talking today with Brian Ford. He's from Yale University. David Thaws from the University of Pittsburgh. Arthur House is the chairman of PURA in Connecticut. That's the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority. We'll be talking more about threats here in Connecticut and nationwide. If you've got thoughts, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, well, the legislature made it through 1 week of a very long session. We'll talk about that and what's to come in our weekly news roundtable, The Wheelhouse. We'll also get the legislative wish list from a transparency advocate. Hope you can join the conversation on tomorrow's Where We Live. Since the breach of Sony Pictures and the threats made against the film The Interview, we've been hearing the phrase cyber warfare a lot. But what exactly does that mean? Some say cyber warfare represents a grave new threat to national security, a type of new terrorism. We've heard similar statements, though, before, including back in 2012.
The most destructive scenarios involve cyber actors launching several attacks on our critical infrastructure at one time, in combination with a physical attack on our country. Attackers could also seek to disable or degrade critical military systems and communication networks. The collective result of these kinds of attacks could be a cyber Pearl Harbor.
And that's Leon Panetta speaking in 2012. Of course, President Obama is speaking about cyber warfare this week. If you've got thoughts, 860-275-7266. Mike's in Southington. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's on your mind?
Thanks for having me. I have two questions. I mean, what is Homeland Security doing with the billions of dollars that we are pouring into of taxpayer dollars to address this issue that's been around for years? And number two, why isn't this a corporate responsibility mandated by the government that if you invite us, the consumer, into your business place, that you are liable for actions or misinformation or what have you, that takes place during that transaction? I mean, if you go into a restaurant and you fall or eat bad food, that restaurant is partially on the hook for that.
Well, Mike, you raised two very good questions, and I'd like to put those to Arthur House, who's the chairman of PURA here, actually has been thinking a lot about some of these very issues. I mean, what he's basically saying is, are we spending the money the right way to prevent against cyber warfare? And secondly, what about the big corporations? I mean, as a public utility regulator, you're dealing with big utility monopolies, essentially. They're doing business with the state, and they're very, very important to us. Are they on the hook for some of this?
On the first question, John, caller is right. Where's the money going? And look at this as a race, that you never win a cyber contest. It's a constant ongoing battle all the time. And Homeland Security and other government agencies are constantly trying to stay ahead of the game and to work as they can with other government agencies. FBI Director Comey testified before Homeland Security and Government Affairs that cyber attacks are likely to eclipse terrorism as a domestic danger over the next decade. And right here in Connecticut, UTC did a poll of Congress and the Pentagon and the White House and found that 45% of the respondents believe a cyber attack is the greatest threat to the United States, 20 percentage points above terrorism. So he's right. Are we doing enough? Well, the problem is we're doing a lot, but others continue to invest in it. So it's huge. As far as, can you sue a company that doesn't do enough on cyber? I mean, it does not always know what tomorrow's attack is going to be. There's a huge industry, a big business now of cyber defense, cyber services. And companies try to keep up with them. Some are better at it than others. In Connecticut, what we have to do is to make sure that we have certain agreed standards with the utilities, and they're doing everything reasonable to meet those standards.
Okay, so we need to have those standards in place. I mean, what are the standards right now? I mean, how much does it need to move to get to a place that you'd like to see here?
There is none right now. I would describe the situation.
No, I'm sorry to laugh, but that's actually shocking to, I think, a lot of people in our audience.
Well, I came to this job about 2.5 years ago from the intelligence community in Washington. And when I came, a lot of colleagues said, look, there is no program right now whereby all these threats that we are seeing in the intelligence community, we're not comfortable with the degree of response by the public utilities. So when I came into the job, I talked to the utilities, and up to that point, Connecticut was like every other state. We got it under control. We're doing everything we can do. Pura, on the other hand, was quite formalistic. I mean, they did a formal docket, and they sent out interrogatories, they called them, and questions, which came back with answers such as, can't share that with you or whatever. So you had utilities which previously had been somewhat in denial and a regulatory authority which was too formal, and we've broken that down. I think the utilities now recognize that cybersecurity is a public concern. The governor and the General Assembly have both said we need reassurances that they're taking reasonable measures to protect us. So on Thursday of this week, we're going to start what we call technical meetings. They're informal sessions to see if we can break down those former barriers that we had and agree on standards and how they can be reported to key players so that we can have some idea of what defensive measures are being taken to thwart a cyber attack.
Because one of the things that happens when utility companies come to ratepayers and say they want to make an increase to fees, to rates, is that they want to strengthen their system, their infrastructure.
Right.
They want to make sure that they're hardened against the big winter storms that have knocked us off in the past. So seems to me what you're saying is, in part, coming to some sort of an agreement about what they have to do, not just with the poles and wires, but what they got to do to make sure that, you know, we don't get hacked into.
Well, yeah, welcome to my world. I mean, you want to have storm resilience, you want to have strong cyber, and you want low electricity rates. You're right. There's a conflict there. Matthew Wald, the New York Times, wrote that the U.S. electric grid is the glass jaw of American industry, and that an adversary could black out vast areas of the United States for weeks on end, denying water, food, heat, and create disruptions of a scale that was only hinted at by the attacks of 9/11 and Hurricane Sandy. So in its scope, this is huge, but we have to take reasonable measures. And that comes down to what is appropriate. And I think it's very different for a water company than it is for an electric distribution company, than it is for telecoms or a gas company.
You said in a recent letter to Governor Malloy, you want to have a plan to strengthen cybersecurity in the public utilities, but you also want to amend the Connecticut Freedom of Information Law to protect the public utilities and government from cybersecurity vulnerabilities. What do you mean there?
What I mean is that if we were to set standards, suppose we came up with 8 things like software appropriate, software defense and physical security and corporate culture and training and so forth. And we asked them to report on how they were doing. I would want to protect that information from becoming publicly available. Why? Because I do not want a report from a utility that says we're strong on these 4 factors and these 2 are quite weak and these 2 are in the middle. You don't want to give a blueprint to the bad guys and saying, fine, those are the 2 areas you go attack. I mean, it makes no sense for to make our utilities weak by publicizing shortfalls in their cybersecurity program.
We just have a couple of minutes left, and it's not exactly off topic. It's sort of to this point, but I have to ask you, Chairman House, in that same letter, you and other commissioners talk about a lot of things that you wish were different about your world with Governor Malloy. He addressed one of those yesterday in a meeting with reporters, essentially saying if you and other commissioners didn't like the way that you were subsumed part of DEEP, that you would, you might need to resign or step down from your job. I'm just wondering if you could respond quickly to what the governor said.
Thanks, John. I'd rather stay to cybersecurity this morning.
Well, I understand that. I guess one of the things I wonder about is it seems as though one of the problems around the way in which we've arranged things here at the state is that your public utility regulatory authority is inside an agency that in part promotes energy in the state. I mean, is that part of, I suppose, the issue that we're dealing with here, that we don't have enough people looking at the very specific things they need to do in the state, and we've got this one uber organization that oversees environmental protection and also energy and the promotion of energy here in the state?
I do want to stay with cyber, but I will say this, that the governor and the General Assembly have both agreed that we should undertake these series of technical meetings to get our arms around the entire cybersecurity threat. The utilities have been very cooperative. They've said, yes, let's do that. They will not be compelled to testify. They're coming voluntarily. And my hope is that through these sessions, both the general session and one with each area, we're going to be able to come up with a plan which will result in standards and in reports that will have a reasonable level of assurance to the governor, to the General Assembly, and to PURA that the Connecticut utilities are doing what is reasonable to protect the citizens of Connecticut.
David, I wanted to ask you about some of the vulnerabilities that we might have to our electric grid. Arthur House seems concerned about many of these things. Getting back to this question of the Internet of Things, is this potentially one of our vulnerabilities here?
Absolutely. And in the sense of we talk about protecting public utilities, we need to think about public utilities as being more broad than just the traditional definitions, because Google may be a public utility. And if I use my Google account and the single sign-on services with Google to manage, say in California, and this hopefully will be coming to Connecticut soon for some good reasons, but also bears risks, what we call demand response in the home. So that's my utilities, will run the washing machine, the dishwasher, at times when electricity costs less because it's not the middle of the day in the hot Connecticut humid summer when my air conditioning is running. Well, I'm not going to be able to take – it's a lot harder to directly attack a utility company's control systems because they're probably not, or we hope they're not, directly integrated into the Internet. But if I can use that compromise of several Google accounts or – some other mechanism to cause those sensors in the home all to think that it's the middle of the night and electricity is cheap at the same time in every home in Connecticut, I can cause a massive surge in the demand. And if I can do that with businesses as well. Historically what massive surges in demand can cause. And those are not the types of things that are easy and cheap for utilities to prepare for and survive through.
And I've got to break in just because we've run low on time. I want to thank David Thaw from the University of Pittsburgh and Brian Ford from Yale University. I'll say, Arthur House, I think we should have you back and talk about this entire idea of could Google ever be a utility here in Connecticut? That's the sort of thing. That's an entirely new discussion. I want to thank you all very much for sharing in this important conversation. If you want to continue the conversation online, go to WNPR.org. It's the Wheelhouse tomorrow, and this is where we live.